I knew that it would be futile to inquire further, but as we wandered among the bodies, I asked another burning question. Do you have Moses' body? And why are they all in levitation in this doko without a solid floor? We have only the body of Christ from your planet. They are levitated in order to be perfectly preserved, and the properties peculiar to the waters of this lake assist this preservation. Who are all the others? They came from various planets where they have each had a very important role to play. One of the bodies I remember well, it was about 50 centimeters high and formed exactly like a being from Earth, except that it was dark yellow and had no eyes. Instead, it had a type of horn in the middle of its forehead. I asked how it was able to see and was told that there were two eyes at the end of the protuberance, multifaceted like the eyes of a fly. I could see the closed eyelid with several splits. Nature is very strange, I murmured. As I said, each body you see here comes from a different planet, and it is the conditions in which they must live which determines the details of the physical bodies of the inhabitants. I don't see anyone resembling Arki. And neither will you. I didn't know why, but I felt that I should not pursue this topic further. Throughout this macabre visit, I saw bodies resembling North American Red Indians, but they weren't. I saw others like Black Africans, but they weren't, nor was it the body of a Japanese that I saw floating in the air. As Thou had said, Christ's was the only body here that came, if one can say so, from Earth. After an indeterminate time in this extraordinary and fascinating place, my guides led me outside. A lightly perfumed breeze carrying the scent of the forest caressed us and did me much good, for after such a visit, in spite of it being enormously interesting, I was feeling quite drained. Thou, of course, realized as much and said, in a lively voice, "Are you ready, Michelle? We are going home." These words, spoken intentionally in French and with an intonation distinctly earthly, refreshed me at least as much as the evening breeze. Taking hold of my litialak, I rose in the air with the others. We flew over the giant forest that climbed the rocky mountain slope. At its peak, we could, again, admire the ocean that stretched as far as the eye could see. Following a macabre afternoon, and in contrast to it, I found this planet even more beautiful. I remember it occurring to me again, momentarily, that perhaps this was all a dream or an illusion, or that, perhaps, my mind was failing me. As usual though, Thou was on guard and intervened with a sharp order that resounded telepathically in my head like the crack of a whip, dispelling my vague doubts. If you don't press your litialak, Michelle, you will end up taking a bath and, if we don't hurry, night will overtake us. That might be a little inconvenient for you. Don't you think? Indeed, lost in my thoughts, I had descended and almost touched the waves. I pressed my litialak firmly and shot up like an arrow, joining Thou and the others who were high in the sky. The sun was already quite low and the sky was totally clear. The ocean had taken on an orange color, which was surprising. I never would have imagined water could appear such a shade. Inquiring about it, telepathically, it was explained to me that, sometimes, at this time of day, immense patches of orange-colored plankton would rise to the surface. These waters, it appeared, contained enormous quantities of plankton. What a sight it was! The sky was blue-green, the sea was orange, and everything was enveloped in the golden light which, on this planet, seemed to come from nowhere and everywhere. Quite suddenly, my companions gained altitude and I followed them. We were about 1,000 meters above the sea and accelerated in the direction we'd come from, I guessed north, to about 300 kilometers per hour. Looking in the direction of the setting sun, I could make out a wide, black band on the water's surface. I didn't have to ask about it. The answer came quickly. It is Nuraka, one of the continents. It's as big as the whole of Asia. Are we going to visit it? I asked. Thou didn't reply, which quite surprised me. It was the first time she had ignored my question. I thought perhaps my telepathic powers had not been sufficient and, so, I asked the question again, in French, raising my voice as I did so. "Look over there," she said. Turning my head, I saw a veritable cloud of birds of every color, about to cross our path. Fearing a collision with them, I descended several hundred meters. They skimmed by me at an incredible speed, but was it they who traveled so fast, or us? I thought perhaps it was our combined speeds that made them disappear so quickly, but, just then, something astonished me greatly. Looking above me, I saw that Thau and the others had not changed their altitude. How was it they hadn't collided with this winged squadron? Glancing at Thau, I realized she had followed my thoughts, and it occurred to me that the birds had appeared at quite an opportune time, just when I had posed my question. Accustomed to Thau, I knew that she would have her reasons for ignoring me, and I let the matter drop. I decided, instead, to take advantage of this opportunity to fly without wings, and I allowed myself to become intoxicated by the colors around me, which gradually changed as the sun sank towards the horizon. The pastel shades that washed over the sky were of a majesty quite indescribable with my pen. I thought I had already witnessed all the symphonies of color possible on this planet, and yet I was mistaken. From our altitude, the effect of the colors of the sky, sometimes contrasting with those of the ocean and sometimes complementing them perfectly, was spectacular. How incredible it was that nature could coordinate such a range of colors, always changing, always beautiful. I felt again the beginning of the drunkenness which had previously caused me to faint, and received the order, brief and clear, "Close your eyes immediately, Michel." I obeyed, and the sensation of drunkenness dissipated. However, it is not easy to pilot a Lityaluk and to remain in formation with closed eyes, especially when one is a novice in the area. Inevitably, I strayed left and right, up and down. Another order was given, this time less urgent: "Watch/use his back, Michel. Don't take your eyes off him and watch his wings." I opened my eyes to see Lachusi in front of me. Strangely, it did not surprise me at all that he had sprouted black wings, and I fixed all my concentration on them. After a time, Thau approached me, saying in French, "We're nearly there, Michel, follow us." I found it equally natural that Lachusi had now lost his wings. I followed the group down towards the ocean, where we could make out, like a jewel on a colored tablecloth, the island where my doko was situated. We approached rapidly amidst a fantastic blaze of color as the sun dived into the waves. I had to hurry to my doko. Drunkenness, caused by the beauty of the colors, threatened to overwhelm me again, and I was obliged to close my eyes partially. We flew now at sea level and, before long, crossed the beach and plunged into the foliage surrounding my doko. My landing, however, was unsuccessful, and I found myself inside the doko astride the back of a seat. Lakli was immediately at my side. She pushed in the button of my Lityaluk, asking me if I was all right. "Yes, but those colors," I stammered. No one laughed at my little accident, and everyone seemed a little sad. It was so unusual for them that I was quite thrown by it. We all sat down and helped ourselves to hydromel and dishes of red and green food. I was not feeling very hungry. I had taken off my mask and was beginning to feel more like myself again. Night fell quickly, as it does on Thau Uba, and we sat in darkness. I remember wondering over the fact that, while I could barely distinguish each of them, they could see me as easily as if it were daylight. No one spoke, we sat in silence. Looking up, I could see the stars appearing one by one, shining colorfully as though a firework display had frozen in the sky. On Thau Uba, because their layers of gases in the atmosphere differ from ours, the stars appear to be colored and also much larger than they appear to us on Earth. Suddenly, I broke the silence, asking, quite naturally, "Where is Earth?" As if the group had simply been waiting for this question, they all rose together. Lakli took me in her arms like a child, and we went outside. The others led the way, and we followed a wide path that led to the beach. There, on the moist sand of the shore, Lakli set me down. Minute by minute, the firmament was illuminated by more stars, as though a giant hand was lighting a chandelier. thou approached me and almost whispered in a voice that was sad and one I could hardly recognize as hers, "Do you see those four stars, Michelle, just above the horizon? They almost form a square. The one on the top right is green and shinier than the others." "Yes, I think that's it, yes, it forms a square, the green, yes. Now go to the right of the square and slightly higher. You will see two red stars quite close together. Yes. Keep your eye on the one on the right and go a tiny bit higher. Can you see a tiny white star? It's barely visible." "I think so. Yes. And on its left a little higher is a tiny yellow one." "Yes, that's right. The tiny white one is the sun which lights up the planet Earth. So, where is Earth?" "Invisible from here, Michelle. We are too far away." I remained there, staring at that minuscule star which seemed so insignificant in a sky filled with large colorful jewels. That minuscule star, however, was perhaps at that very moment warming my family and my home, making plants germinate and grow. My family, the words seemed so strange. Australia, from this perspective I had trouble imagining it to be the largest island on my planet, especially when even Earth was invisible to the naked eye. Yet, I'd been told we belonged to the same galaxy, and the universe comprised thousands of galaxies. What were we, poor human bodies? Hardly much more than an atom. Chapter 13. Coming Back Home. The sheets of galvanized iron on the roof creak under the burning rays of the sun, and even on the veranda, the heat is almost unbearable. I watch the delightful play of light and shadow in the garden and hear the song of the birds as they chase each other across a pale blue sky, and I am sad. I have just put the final full stop at the end of the 12th chapter of this book I was asked to write. The task was not always easy. Often details would escape me and I would spend hours trying to recall certain things which Thou had said, and particular things she wanted me to write. Then, at the moment when I was totally exasperated, it would all come back to me, every detail, as if a voice was dictating the words over my shoulder, and I would write so much I would develop cramps in my hand. For periods of about 3 hours, sometimes more, sometimes less, images would crowd into my head. While writing the book, with words jostling each other in my mind, I often wished I had known shorthand, and now, again, the strange sensation is back. "Are you there, Thou?" I would ask, never receiving a reply. "Is it one of you? Thou? Biestra? Latli? Lashusi? I beg you to give me a sign, a sound. Please respond. You called me?" I had spoken aloud and my wife had come running. She stood in front of me, watching me closely. "No. You are doing this periodically, aren't you, talking to yourself? I will be glad when this book is finished and you come back to Earth, literally." She left. Poor Lena. She certainly has not had an easy time of it, these past months. How must it have been for her? She got up one morning to find me stretched out on the sofa, deathly pale, having difficulty breathing and desperately wanting to sleep. I asked her if she had found my note. "Yes," she said, "but where did you get to? I know you're going to find this hard to believe, but I was picked up by extraterrestrials and taken to their planet. I will tell you everything, but for now, please, just let me sleep for as long as possible. I'll go to bed now, I stretched out here so as not to wake you. Your tiredness is not, I suppose, due to some other reason?" Her tone was bittersweet and I could sense her concern. However, she let me sleep and it was a good 36 hours before I opened an eye. I woke to find Lena bending over me, with the anxious air of a nurse watching someone gravely ill. "How are you?" she asked. "I very nearly called the doctor. I haven't known you to sleep for so long without once stirring, and yet you were dreaming and calling out in your sleep. Who is the Archaeorica you mentioned? And how? Are you going to tell me?" I smiled at her and kissed her. "I'm going to tell you everything. It occurred to me then, that thousands of husbands and wives must say that very same sentence, having no intention whatsoever of explaining everything. I wished I'd said something a little less vulgar and common. Yes, I'm listening. Good, and you must listen carefully, for what I have to say is serious, very serious. But I don't want to tell the same story twice. Call our son in, so I can tell you both. 3 hours later, I had largely finished my account of the extraordinary adventure I'd had. Lena, who is the least credulous member of the family when it comes to such matters, had detected, by certain expressions and certain intonations in my voice, that something really serious had happened to me. When one lives 27 years with a person, some things cannot be misunderstood. I was besieged with questions, especially from my son, for he has always believed in the existence of other planets inhabited by intelligent beings. "Do you have proof?" asked Lena. I was reminded of Thau's words, "They seek proof, Michelle, and always more proof." I was a little disappointed the question came from my own wife. "No, none, but when you read the book that I must write, you will know that I tell the truth. You won't have to believe, you will know. Can you imagine me telling my friends, 'My husband has just come back from the planet Thiouba?'" I asked her to speak of the matter to no one, since my orders were not to speak, but first to write. I felt it was better that way, in any case, because words can be lost in the breeze whereas what is written, remains. The days and months passed by and now the book is finished. All that remains to be done is to publish it. On this subject, Thau had assured me there would be few problems. This was in response to a question I had asked in the spacecraft on our return to Earth. The spacecraft, how many things that word brings to mind. That last evening, on the beach, Thau had pointed out the minuscule star that is the sun that now made me perspire. We had then taken the flying platform and headed for the space, quickly and without a word being spoken. A spaceship, prepared for immediate departure, awaited us. During our brief journey to the base, I had observed in the darkness that the auras of my companions were not shining as brilliantly as usual. The colors were more subdued and stayed closer to their bodies. This surprised me, but I said nothing. When we boarded the spacecraft, I assumed we were going on a trip, perhaps with a specific mission, to a nearby planet. Thau had told me nothing. Our takeoff went according to normal procedures and was uneventful. I watched as the golden planet became rapidly smaller, presuming I'd be returning in a few hours' time, or perhaps the next day. Several hours had elapsed before Thau finally addressed me again. "Michelle, I know you have noticed our sadness. It is very real, for there are certain partings that are sadder than others. My companions and I have become very attached to you and, if we are sad, it is because, at the end of this journey, we must part. We are taking you back to your planet." Again, I felt a twinge in the side of my stomach. "I hope you won't hold it against us that we left so quickly. We did so to spare you the regrets one always has when one leaves a place one is fond of, and I know you are enormously fond of our planet, and our company. It's hard not to think, this is my last night or this is the last time I will see this or that." I looked down and had absolutely nothing to say. We sat together in silence for some time. I felt heavy, as though my limbs and organs were weighted. I turned my head slowly towards Thau, looking at her surreptitiously. She seemed even sadder and something different was missing. Suddenly, I knew, it was her aura. "Thau, what's happening to me? I can't see your aura anymore." "It's normal, Michelle. The great Thari gave you your two gifts, the ability to see auras and understand languages, to serve as tools in your learning, but only for a limited time. This time has just elapsed, but don't be saddened by the fact, after all, these are gifts you didn't have when you first joined us. What you do take back is knowledge that you and millions of your fellow beings can profit from. Isn't that more important than understanding languages or being able to see auras when you aren't able to read them? It is the reading of auras that counts, after all, not the perceiving of them. I accepted her reasoning, but was disappointed nonetheless, for I had soon become accustomed to the radiance around these people. "Don't be sorry, Michelle," said Thau, reading my thoughts. "On your planet, most people don't have radiant auras, far from it. The thoughts and concerns of millions of Earthlings are so closely related to material matters, that their auras are quite dull. You'd have been disappointed." I looked at her closely, very conscious of the fact that soon I would see her no more. In spite of her large size, she was so well proportioned, her pleasant pretty face was without a wrinkle, her mouth, her nose, her eyebrows, all were perfect. Suddenly, the question that had been brewing in my subconscious mind for so long sprung to mind almost involuntarily. "Thau, is there a reason for you all being hermaphrodites?" "Yes, and it is important, Michelle. I was surprised you didn't ask that question sooner. You see, as we exist on a superior planet, all we have that is material, is also superior, as you have seen for yourself. Our various bodies, including the physical body, must also be superior, and in this domain, we have progressed as far as it is possible to progress. We can regenerate our bodies, prevent them from dying, resuscitate them and even, sometimes, create them. But in a physical body, there are other bodies, such as the astral. Indeed, there are 9 altogether. Those which interest us at the moment are the fluidic body and the physiological body. The fluidic body influences the physiological body, which, in turn, influences the physical body. In the fluidic body, you possess 6 principal points which we call corollas and which the yogis on your planet call chakras. The first chakra is the one situated between your 2 eyes, just 1.5 centimeters above your nose. It's the brain of your fluidic body, if you like. It corresponds to the pineal gland, which is placed much further back in your physical brain but on exactly the same level. It was by placing a finger on this chakra that one of the Thari was able to liberate in you the gift of understanding languages. Now, at the bottom of the fluidic body and just above the sex organs, is found a very important chakra, which we call the Muladhara, and which your yogis call sacred. Above this chakra, and meeting the spinal column, is the Palanchus. It is in the form of a coiled spring and only reaches the base of the spinal column when it is relaxed. For it to become relaxed, it requires the accomplishment of the sexual act between 2 partners who must not only love one another, but also have a spiritual affinity between them. Only at that moment and under these conditions will the Palanchus extend to the spinal column, transferring an energy and special gifts to the physiological body, which then affects the physical body. The person concerned will experience happiness in sexual enjoyment that is far greater than normal. When, on your planet, you hear such expressions among people very much in love as, "We were in 7th heaven, we felt light," or "We were floating on air," you can be sure the couples were in physical and spiritual accord and made for one another, at least for a while. Certain tantrists on Earth have attained this point, but it isn't common among them, for still their religions, with ridiculous rituals and prohibitions, create a real obstacle to attaining this goal. When they look at the forest, they don't see the trees. Let's go back to our loving couple. The man has experienced great pleasure transformed into beneficial vibrations for the Palanchus, thanks to a love which is genuine, and absolute compatibility. All these sensations of happiness were released by the accomplishment of the sexual act. The sensations of happiness are not the same with the female, but the process is the same with her. Now, to answer your question. On our planet, with bodies that are both male and female, we can achieve, at will, the sensations, both male and female. Of course, this brings us a much greater range of sexual pleasure than if we were monosexual. Further, our fluidic body can be at its best. Our appearance is, needless to say, more feminine than masculine, at least where our faces and breasts are concerned. Don't you agree, Michelle, that, as a general rule, a woman has a prettier face than a man? Well, we prefer to have faces that are pretty, rather than unattractive. What do you think of homosexuality? The homosexual, female as well as male, is a neurotic, when it is not a matter of hormones, and neurotics can't be condemned but, like all neurotics, they should seek treatment. In all things, Michelle, consider what nature has decreed and you will have the answers to your questions. Nature gave every living thing the possibility of reproduction, so, that various species might continue. According to the Creator's will, males and females have been created in all species. With human beings, however, and for the reasons we have already explained, he added features not given to other species. For example, a woman can bloom in sexual fulfillment, achieving a range of sexual sensations that can release the phalanges and bring about vast improvements in her physical body by way of the fluidic body. That can happen over numerous days of the month without her becoming pregnant. A cow, on the other hand, will accept the bull only during a certain few hours of the month and, then, it is motivated only by the drive to procreate. When in calf, she is no longer receptive to a bull's advances. There you have a comparison between two of nature's creations. The first is quite a special being, possessing 9 bodies, whereas the second possesses only 3 bodies. Evidently, the Creator has taken special care to place, within us, much more than a physical body. Sometimes, on your planet, these special things are referred to as divine sparks, and it is an appropriate comparison. What do you think of deliberate abortion? Is it a natural act? No, of course not. Then why do you ask? You already know the answer. I recall that thou remained as though lost in thought for quite some time, looking at me without speaking. Then she resumed, for approximately 140 years on your planet, man has been accelerating the destruction of nature and the pollution of the environment. This has happened since the discovery of steam power and the combustion engine. You have but a few years left in which to arrest the pollution before the situation becomes irreversible. One of the principal pollutants on Earth is the petrol-driven engine, and this could be replaced immediately with a hydrogen engine that would cause no pollution, so to speak. On certain planets, this is called the clean motor. Prototypes for such an engine have been constructed by various engineers on your planet, but they must be industrially manufactured in order to replace petrol engines. Not only would this measure mean a 70% reduction in current levels of pollution by combustion waste, but it would also be more economical for consumers. The big petrol corporations had been terrified at the idea of this motor being popularized, for it would mean loss of sales for their oil and subsequent financial ruin. Governments, too, who impose enormous taxes on these oils, would suffer equally. You see, Michelle, it always comes back to money. Because of it, you have a whole economic and financial context that opposes progress towards radical change in the interest of all human life on Earth. The people on Earth allow themselves to be pushed around, bullied, exploited and led to the abattoirs by political and financial cartels, which are sometimes even associated with well-known sects and religions. When these cartels fail to win the people with clever advertising campaigns intended to brainwash them, they try to succeed through political channels, and next through religion or through a clever blend of the lot. Great men wanting to do something for mankind have simply been done away with. Martin Luther King is one example, Gandhi is another. But the people of Earth can no longer allow themselves to be treated as fools and led to the abattoirs like flocks of sheep by leaders that they, themselves, have democratically elected. The people formed the vast majority. In a nation of 100 million inhabitants, it is absurd that a group of financiers comprising perhaps 1,000 individuals can decide the fate of the others, like the butcher does at the abattoir. Such a group has well and truly stifled the business of the hydrogen motor so that it is no longer mentioned. These people couldn't care less what might happen to your planet in years to come. Selfishly, they seek their gains, expecting to be dead before whatever is going to happen happens. If the Earth disappears, as a result of horrific cataclysms, they assume they will already be dead. There, they are making a big mistake, for the source of the coming disasters is the pollution which is growing daily on your planet, and its consequences will be felt very soon, much sooner than you can imagine.